Blog Talk Radio.
Show. My name is Don Allen. Over at Studio B, we have Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you doing this afternoon?
Really good, Don, even though the temperature is kind of plunging. It really does feel like late fall now here in Minnesota,
yes,
so people can get ready for, I hope it's not any significant inclement weather, but, you know, you can kind of get ready. But I understand we have a distinguished guest with us, professor from Hamline University there in St. Paul, renowned expert, really, in many respects, and most importantly, very, very well respected for his opinions and observations. We're going to lead off with you, Don, introducing him and kind of have some discussion. I've got some questions later on. He's going to be with us, I understand, at least 20 minutes, right?
Yeah, hopefully there. We're trying to keep him that long. He's a
right.
good man.
Phone lines will be open after that. After that, the
yes.
phone lines will be open. So, Don, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest?
Tonight we'd like to welcome David Schultz, professor at Hamline University in the Department of Political Science, where he teaches classes in American politics, policy, administration, and ethics. Professor Schultz also holds an appointment at the University of Minnesota Law School, where he teaches election law, state constitutional law, and professional responsibility, in parentheses, ethics. Professor Schultz, welcome to Ron on the show.
Thank you for having me on the show tonight.
Okay, appreciate it. Appreciate you being here. I'd like to start off first. There's been a lot of campaign commercials here on television. Obviously, the election is a few days away, next Tuesday on the 4th. What is your general opinion of, let's just start with this. Stuart Mills, I've seen a lot of commercials that are kind of attacking him, saying that he inherited money, he's a businessman, and I mean, why? Someone want to be in a position to inherit
Don, let me just do this. Our reception is not good. Let me ask the professor, are you having good reception, professor? Because that's what's important. Because on my headset, Don, you're breaking up.
Yeah, he is breaking up quite a bit, but I did hear the question. And
okay, Don,
I
you got to make that adjustment
it.
In studio. Yeah.
Okay, I will do that. Okay, I will take care of that. Yeah, so based on the question on what broken up a little bit. What is your opinion about the Stuart Mills piece and why he would attack for being successful?
Well, let me just think about what the strategy seems to be. That most of the ads that are going after Stuart Mills, at least being broadcast in the Twin Cities area, are either making fun of him because of his long hair or referencing the fact that he comes from a wealthy family. And I'm not necessarily sure that those are the most effective ads in the world. For the most part, I don't think too many people care about how long his hair is. You know, it just doesn't seem to be a big issue. I know clearly, you know, baby boomers of my generation, you know, what do we care about long hair? We all had it when we were younger. But I don't think young people care about it. So I just don't think that's a big issue. You know, but the issue of attacking somebody because they're wealthy, again, I'm not sure how well that's, again, playing at this point. Now, if they want to go after him and focus on the issue of saying that he's out of touch, is, you know, with regular people, that they don't like his positions on taxes or something like that, I think it's not bad. But just sort of simply these ads that are trying to say he's rich and that's a reason to vote against him, I'm not sure that's the most effective advertising in terms of being used by either Democrats or groups supporting Democrats at this point.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you on that 100%. Now, do you think in this election cycle the Republicans have done their due diligence as far as outreach to unique communities? I know the Minnesota GOP here has sung to the choir quite a bit in this election cycle. And just from your perspective, from your point of view, how do you feel or what do you think about their efforts to kind of do outreach in communities where they have not done that probably
in general,
since 2008?
Yeah. In general, I mean, and the Republicans, you know, after the 2012 election, issued a study nationally, and they said they need to do a better job reaching out, especially to Hispanic America. They talked a little bit less about African Americans and Asians, but clearly talked about Hispanics. And I would say that they're still doing a lot more lip service than they are really sort of reaching out to communities of color at this point. And I think, yeah, and I think the dilemma that the Republicans face is that their current base is old. It is white, it is Christian, and it's a base that is not supportive of the types of issues that might be of interest to many people in the community of color. And unless the Republican Party figures out how to reach out to these new communities, it's literally going to go the way of T-Rex and the dinosaurs. And so it's caught. It needs to figure out a way of reaching out to a new community of people, but its current base won't let them. And so even in this election, I don't feel like they're doing a very good job of reaching out to a diverse population. And I'd even throw in that, you know, not just communities of color, but also the gay lesbian community. Having said that, I think oftentimes the Democrats take for granted that they have the votes of African Americans, Hispanics, and so forth, and in many situations are really not actively reaching out as well as they could. And so I have to say that both of the parties, in many cases, either give lip service or take for granted that certain communities are going to vote for them and are not doing a good job of really reaching out to diverse populations.
Okay, thank you. And have you been following at all the CD4 race between Sharna and Betty McCulloch? And that effort, it looks like that Sharna might be a little bit behind. And what was the issues that you see in that particular race, if you've been following that closely?
Well, that's a race that probably I haven't put as much focus on as some of the other ones. I mean, the two races that I've sort of been concentrating on more, you know, have been, again, the Stuart Mills race, which is the 8th district, and then the 7th district, which is, you know, Colin Peterson's seat. You know, when I look at sort of the races that are, again, you know, close, you know, right on top of the Twin Cities, you know, we've got, you know, Betty McCollum's district, which she's going to win pretty handily. We've got Keith Ellison's. But when I look at other districts, for example, where Eric Paulson is, for example, his district, that's one that the Democrats, I think, foolishly are not heavily challenging. On the other hand, the John Klein district, which the Democrats seem to be kind of challenging, they don't seem to be really competitive in that one. So I have sort of found that this year that the strategy that the Democrats are using, at least in the state of Minnesota, isn't a particularly effective one in many of the competitive districts. And that's why I think they're probably not going to do that well this year, on top of the fact they have the liability of a president who's not popular, and at the same time having a decreased voter turnout this year.
Okay, you just mentioned something. Eric Paulson's district, he's running against one of the candidates there is Sharon Sun. Do you don't think she's done well among the women in the 3rd district out there?
I think she's interesting in a sense that she's a bright, articulate candidate, and I think has a lot to offer. But she's not getting an awful lot of support from the DCCC, the Democratic Campaign Congressional Committee, and that's made it difficult for her to really to be able to do the kind of messaging and work she needs. You know, from what little I've seen, you know, and I've met her before, I think she's an engaging candidate who should be able to reach out to women, you know, within that district. But again, lacking the resources, lacking the support that she needs, I think she's been significantly handicapped in her ability to really be able to get a message out to a lot of different people.
Okay, well, here's something that I want to kind of change the flow a little bit. You know, about 2 weeks ago, there was a Senate hearing, ethics hearing,
with Senator Champion over the CSI and also the community action.
Senator Hayden.
Senator Hayden with the CSI and the community action involvement. What is your take on that? We know that Senator Hayden has on his resume that he kind of oversees nonprofits. That's his area. And, you know, he did appoint someone to represent him. Is he still responsible, the responsible person on that board, or would it be the person he appointed?
He is responsible. Minnesota law is exceedingly clear on this issue, is that if you're on the board of directors for a nonprofit, and I used to teach nonprofit law, I taught it for 15 years, if you are on a nonprofit board of directors, you have what's called a fiduciary duty, a responsibility to act in the best interest of that organization. And the law actually requires you to do a variety of things. It requires you to show up to board meetings. It requires you to, what I call, do your homework, which means to read the board minutes, to be aware of what's going on in the organization, and to basically be responsible, because you're what? You're one of the directors. You're responsible for the legal entity of a nonprofit. And so if you don't show up to meetings, if you just sort of say, well, I'm going to send somebody in my place, that's fine, except that's not what the law says. The law holds you responsible. And so that one of the questions that we have to ask here, you know, with the Community Action Program of Minneapolis is that, you know, where were these board members? You know, they should have been asking questions a long time ago regarding how the money was being spent. Nonprofits like that are required to have a yearly audit. Board members are supposed to participate and review that audit. You know, what happened? Why didn't those board members participate in that audit? You know, what did they know? What did they not know? And so I think there's real questions for both Hayden and for Champion, you know, in terms of, you know, were they basically negligent in their duties as board members? And it's not impossible at some point, you know, if somebody wants to come back and sue that organization for misappropriation of funds, they could be named not only in their official capacity as board members, but also potentially in their individual capacity as individuals. And so that's one issue. Where were they? Then the second issue, which is what the hearing was about already with Hayden and the one coming up with Champion, is to really ask, was their role or their negligence, whatever you want to call it, on that board so significant that it cast disrepute upon the Senate in Minnesota? And that's what the hearing was about 2 weeks ago, and not a surprise, it deadlocked. Three Republicans said basically yes, three Democrats said no, it's going to go nowhere. And if I made a prediction on the Champion hearing, it's going to be the exact same thing. It's going to go into a partisan deadlock, and they're not going to be able to resolve that one also.
Okay, let me just for a second, Professor, let me just get clarity on something you just said. Senator Champion is not a person of interest as it pertains to the CAP agency. He's a person of interest as it pertains to CSI.
I'm sorry, CSI. I misspoke. I'm sorry. Yes, you're correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. With that said, thank you, Mr. Richardson. With that said, you know, we have Minneapolis City Council President Barb Johnson, City Councilman Long Yang, who both appointed folks to go in their place. Long Councilman Yang reported had Natalie Lee Johnson to go in his place. And I'm not sure the person's name hasn't come up for in Congressman Keith Ellison and Minneapolis City Council President Barb Johnson. Why do you think they're not getting as much heat in the case of Community Action? Why aren't they getting as much heat as Senator Hayden is getting?
Well, I think they should. And what I'm hoping is not the case is that it's all about race. You know, what I'm hoping is a variety of things. I'm hoping that people didn't cut the Community Action Program significant slack and not provide oversight to it, that is the state, when they gave them money, because it was a group working with communities of color. And at the same time, I hope they're not focusing in on them because they're people of color, and I want to hope that the focus isn't on Hayden simply because of his race also. But if we look at, for example, you know, Barb Johnson, you know, she's just as culpable, but she wasn't, you know, but she's not being singled out and no one's talking about her. And so, you know, maybe I want to be a little naive and just say it has nothing to do with race, but I suspect a lot of it does have to do with race at this point.
Okay, now let's jump over to the Minneapolis Public Schools. Now, where in this case, Champion is a person of interest. The Star Tribune reported that someone in the school district, they didn't give out a source, but an official statement released by Stan Allen from the Communications Department with Minneapolis Public Schools said that a staff person there felt pressured, and they used the word threatened, to support this $375,000 allocation from the Senate to the Minneapolis Public Schools for CSI. How would they be able, if you could even speak on this, how would they be able to prove that if the Star Tribune is not going to give them their source, and all the Republicans have at this time is the Star Tribune article, which was used heavily in the Hayden hearing? I mean, how are they going to make that manifest into something against Champion?
Well, it'll be difficult, but the way it would have to occur is that the Hennepin County prosecutor, John Freeman, you know, county attorney, you know, Mike Freeman, you know, had the ability to subpoena a newspaper and request information about their sources. It's, in fact, it's part of a criminal investigation now. So that would be one way that it could happen, is that Freeman does an investigation, does the subpoena. Star Tribune can make a decision. Do they want to basically fight the subpoena or do they want to comply? But if that information were then gathered by the county attorney then could turn it over to, at that point, over to the state legislature to do their investigation also. But short of a criminal investigation at this point, it would be very difficult, unless the Star Tribune voluntarily turned it over, to be able to get that information. And you're right, you know, short of actually having the details of where they, you know, from that source to be able to come in and testify, probably simply on the basis of a newspaper article, it's going to be difficult to do an investigation to really gather the kind of information one would need to make some kind of decision about whether, what role, if any, the senator had in this matter.
Okay, Mr. Edwards.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Allen. And, Professor, again, welcome. I'm going to move more to the national scene and a tad to the international for the purpose of this program, particularly given your background and your innate understanding of how government works. The prognosticators and forecasters are indicating that a swing of 6 votes will in fact put the Congress into the hands of the Republicans, and the 6 vote swing would, of course, be in the Senate. Your take as it pertains to election night next Tuesday, do the Republicans have the momentum and the juice, if you will, to make that swing and to take control of the Senate and make the final 2 years of President Barack Obama's presidency miserable? Or will they kind of split the table, if you will?
Okay, first off, I think the question won't be, will they make the last 2 years miserable? It'll be, will they make it more miserable than it is right now? Because right now, it's not exactly been too good. But, yeah, I mean, right now, I think the Republicans look like they have a very good shot in terms of being able to take over the Senate. The thing that Obama is facing and the Democrats are facing this year is something very similar to what they faced 4 years ago. And I call it the problem of a narrative. You know, 4 years ago in 2010, you know, the Democrats didn't have a compelling narrative as to why they should stay in power and why you should continue to vote for Democrats. And I think that's the same problem again this year, is that the Democrats and Obama need some kind of rationale, some type of argument that rallies their troops, that gives them a reason for people to vote for them. And I think it's not there. On the other hand, the Republicans still don't have a great narrative, you know, but they have a narrative that at least says, you don't like the status quo, vote for us. And so So I think at this point, the combination of an unpopular president, of midterm elections where voting is usually lower, where a lot of Democrats don't vote during midterm elections, and sort of what I call the absence of a narrative by Democrats, really are creating the recipe for the Republicans to do very well. I think
right.
the only way.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the only way I think the Democrats save themselves if they pull up a couple of upsets. You know, one possibility is that the Democrats might be able to pick up a Senate seat in Georgia. The race between Democrat Michelle Nunn and the Republican Perdue is very, very close. Democrats could win that one, and it's still not inconceivable that Allison Grimes could win the Senate seat in Kentucky. And if that were to happen, that might basically offset the losses that the Democrats are going to face elsewhere in the country. And
Let me ask you a question. On that, based on that narrative, if you will, what is the possibility in Kansas where Roberts is running behind the incumbent?
Yeah, and that's the other one too, because the independent there, depending on which poll you look at, is either slightly ahead or dead even. And most speculation is that if the independent candidate wins and beats Roberts, who's the Republican, most people are suspecting that the independent would caucus with the Democrats in terms of voting. And so that becomes a third one. So if the Democrats were to pick up, let's say, two of three states, if they were to pick up Kansas, Kentucky, Georgia, pick up two or three of those, that would probably be enough to offset what seems to be a likely possibility at this point for the Republicans to be able to take over the Senate. Now, there's still a couple of other races. For example, the North Carolina race is very, very close at this point. The Iowa race is Arkansas is still close. So it's still possible that the Democrats could hang on. But even if the Democrats hang on, Obama is not going to face any better prospects in the next 2 years than
he faced
now.
Let me go to that, because this is a question that I know many constitutionalists want to stay away from and most pollsters want to stay away from. Given the continued presence of the Tea Party as it pertains to influence, if you will, and let's say that the Republicans do take control of the Senate, do you think that the Republicans going into 2016 and, of course, being obsessed with winning back the presidency, do you think that they would attempt to move articles of impeachment against Obama?
I would think that they would learn the lesson from what happened back in the 90s when they moved for articles of impeachment against Clinton, and that boomerang down the Republicans in terms of eventually producing significant sympathy and support for Clinton. And so I think they would be foolish to do it, you know, in the sense that first off, you'd have to really come up with, you know, some serious articles of impeachment. Now, granted, back with Clinton, lying about having sex with Monica Lewinsky, you know, essentially lying to the special prosecutor wasn't exactly the strongest article. So I'm still not sure they have anything strong here. They have policy disagreements. They can say that Obama, in their mind, is not popular, or they don't like what he's doing, but that may be not enough for impeachment. And again, they would be smart if they learned from the previous mistakes and didn't do that, because I think that would then boomerang on the Republicans in 2016 and help galvanize the Democrats.
All right. Well, and that's where you and I would differ, have a different narrative. And let me indicate to you where I'm going with this and continue to press you. Bill Clinton, popular president, though, very popular in many respects. The act was infidelity, if you will, you know, sexual, a lapse in a sexual situation in the pantry at the White House. But also, Bill Clinton was white. Much of the animosity, criticism, and et cetera, that's being driven at Barack Obama has too much race. And that's what many of us in Black America have felt for a long time. Don't you think that the issue of the first Black president who is so hated in so many different quarters would generate both a different opinion and a different narrative, and in fact the Republicans could if overwhelmed, particularly in the House, who would be the managers of a quote-unquote articles of impeachment, do you really think that they have not analyzed the fact of playing the race card? We've not used that word before. Do you really think that they would be scared not to play the race card?
No, they will do it. They will do it. I mean, they will. Let me put it this way: they might impeach. You know, impeachment is what the House does. Can they get a conviction?
Yeah, they're
the Senate? No,
they're the managers. They're the prosecutors. In other words, you're right.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. The mm-hmm. Senate's the judges. Mm-hmm. There'll never be the 2/3 vote in the Senate to do that. You know, because the Democrats will galvanize. But there's no question about it. That so much of the, you're right, the animosity against Obama is all about race, and that, you know, one of the things that I think we've seen over the last 6 years on some level is, I think, an incredible regression on race in America, in the sense that, you know, that I'm not sure if I want to say it's more obvious or it's come out more or whatever it is, but clearly I think the debates in terms of Republican criticisms of Barack Obama and attacks, there's no question that there's like a racial aspect to it, much in the same way that I would even argue that the debate all about Ebola this year. I mean, Ebola this year is just a surrogate for race. There's no question about
it. On that particular question, because that's where I was going next, particularly with your expertise in the area of constitutional law, Minnesota has joined a number of other states with the whole quote-unquote implementation of quarantine. And I fully concur mm-hmm. with you that the race / Ebola / it was Barack Obama's fault, whatever that's supposed to mean, has mm-hmm. created a significant level, I think, of unjustifiable fear in this country. Now, the issue of the quarantine, how say you, sir, on the constitutionality of what is being done by the states, particularly New Jersey, and now even Minnesota in a limited way?
Well, it's interesting. These are laws that go back to the early part of the 20th century. I mean, these are laws that go back to, you know, when we had typhoid, and at that, you know, in a different era, people were justifying those laws and saying that we needed to do them. I mean, presently, you know, I can't speak to the medical aspect of it. You know, I'm not a medical doctor. You know, although I've read that quarantines are not the most effective thing in the world. But from, you know, from sort of a civil liberties point of view, you know, it is very hard, you know, to justify, I think, under the current constitutional interpretation, you know, an argument that said that you can just basically round up the usual suspects, which is what this is, round up suspects at this point and just basically indefinitely detain them. And that's what's going on here. I mean, as I sometimes have said, you know, when I've given lectures, I say fear and prejudice makes us do a lot of stupid things in American history. You know, we burned people back, you know, 400 years ago claiming they were witches. You know, we've done lots of dumb things out of fear and prejudice. And I think it's exactly what's happening right now, too. And even though some of these people, you know, might be white, you know, I think still Ebola, because it has to do with Africa, you know,
Black Africa,
exactly,
yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think it has racial tint all through it at this point, and that's part of the issue that's going on here, is that that anybody who's got anything to do with West Africa is immediately suspect, and it's race-based at this point.
All right. Professor, you've been gracious enough to be with us now for almost half hour, but I have one other additional question, and I had said that I was going to be examining you, if you would, on both domestic. I have an international question, though there are a lot of issues out there. But just 3 months ago, 4 months ago, we were, quote-unquote, wringing our hands. Well, some were wringing their hands on the possibility of a return to the Cold War, nuclear conflict, and et cetera. A partial election in the Ukraine over the past weekend. But Putin continues to be the master, quote-unquote, of the chessboard, if you will. Your observation and prediction on if that issue will, in fact, be in some way settled to the extent that the Ukraine will be made whole, or if, in fact, Vladimir Putin will be able to continue to move his agenda?
I think it's somewhere in the middle, that answer here, that I think the elections this week in Ukraine, this past Sunday in Ukraine, clearly resulted in a majority that wants to move further to the West in terms of its alignment with Europe. And in that sense, Putin lost big. I think he was hoping to kind of scare them in terms of, you know, moving in a different direction. And so he didn't succeed there. He's going to clearly push for sort of separate elections, you know, or elections in a separatist region. But ultimately, I don't think, you know, he's prepared, you know, to send, you know, a real invasion across the border. I think what we're going to see is sort of Ukraine really becomes sort of a mini Cold War for a while, where it's East and West, and I can use that old phrase, battling it out there. And I think the real big issue is going to be, to what extent is Europe and the United States going to be willing, in the short term, for example, you know, to provide fuel to Ukraine, because they need it right now, because they get most of it from Russia. But I think it's going to be a slow grind over there, and I don't see any resolution definitively on one side or the other for a while. But I do think ultimately Ukraine's going to move into the West. It's going to move to the West.
At least part of the Ukraine, primarily the eastern, the western portion.
Western part. Correct.
Yes, the Ukrainian-speaking part, the Russian-speaking part, which are the two prime provinces, which are still under the control of the separatists. I just have a vision and a picture that there's going to be another Munich, if you know what I'm saying, another Neville's Chamberlain. You know, just give away most of Czechoslovakia, but we'll have peace in our time. I think that clearly that has to be weighed. And I do have a belief that Kiev is prepared probably to allow that to happen.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think what we're going to probably see at some point is the western, I get this right, the eastern provinces of Ukraine probably do get absorbed either formally into Russia, or they become, I don't know, we'll call it eastern Ukraine. Semi-autonomous, right? And it's split.
Yes.
I think you're absolutely correct. And so that the parts of Ukraine that used to be historically part of Poland or Lithuania move to the west, and they split. So I think the borders basically change in that country over time. And I don't know whether that's good or bad or not. You know, I was in Ukraine 2 years ago. I taught there, and I was over in Kiev. And on one level, it might not be a bad idea to say that, you know, that the country splits and one half goes one direction, one half goes the other. And that, you know, I hate to say it, but that might not be a bad solution. But I think that's probably the solution that the West is going to eventually agree to.
And in closing, and I again appreciate, that would also be, well, I think in the tradition of John Foster Dulles, that would be a face saver, wouldn't it?
it would be a face saver for everybody, I think,
everybody.
At this point.
For Putin, in the East and the nationalists in the West. Yes.
Exactly.
Professor, again, thank you, Mr. Allen. I turn him back over to you.
Well, Professor Schultz, we thank you very much for spending a little bit over 20 minutes with us tonight. It's very informative. And usually on election night, I see you on TV or on the radio somewhere. Where can you tune in? Or do you know right now where you're going to be at?
I'm going to be at Carol Levin on election night, and I'll be there again on the day after the election in the morning, trying to get some kind of sense of what happened. So hopefully some of your listeners, some of your audience will catch me that night.
All right. Thank you again, Professor.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
No problem. Talk to you soon. Thank you for having me. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Mr. Allen, why don't we give the phone number in case there are any calls that may want to reflect on the excellent dissertation. Really, that's what it was, dissertation, and the Q&A involving the professor, our senior professor, if you will, in constitutional law and et cetera, from Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'll throw that number out there.
Sure. The number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. And Mr. Edwards, last week, write-in candidate for Senate Jack Shepherd filed a federal complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice, the police chief Janae Hartle, and a couple other folks. And it has raised a firestorm in social media and it looks like in City Hall. And
this was the lawsuit filed by who?
Jack Shepard, the write-in candidate.
Oh, yes, our friend in Italy. Yes, Mr. Shepard, who ran in the Democratic, or the primary against Al Franken. No, yeah, okay, from his home in Italy. Yes,
right.
Go ahead.
And
do you have him on? Has he called in?
He's live
yeah,
on
I'm here.
Right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
now, John, why don't you go ahead and bet him, if you will. You've already talked to him. And Jack, welcome, and we certainly have a couple minutes for you. Go right ahead.
Okay.
Yeah,
in the short time that we have, Dr. Shepard, who's also a dentist for our listening audience.
Well, Don, we're going for until 10 o'clock, right?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've got some time for Jack, but go right ahead.
Yeah, we do. Why don't you tell me about the complaint? It was posted on the Independent Business Network and a couple other websites also picked it up, and it's a complaint against Police Chief Harto, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, and the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. And the St. Paul Police Chief. What was the motivation behind this, Mr. Shepard?
Yeah, well, first of all, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we hear you real good. Reception, that's one thing the NSA does well for us. They make sure that we can hear everybody coming from overseas. Go right ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, the important thing is, I ran for the United States Senate under the Independence Party, and they had the legalization of marijuana as one of their issues. So that's what got me interested in studying what's going on with the subject. Then it led me to a very fantastic report by the American Civil Liberties Union. Then after going through that, I was in shock that in they did a study for 10 years from 2000 to 2010, and Minnesota had the second highest increase in racial disparity of any state in the union, of 231%. Then I kept reading, and then it ends up Hennepin County, out of, I don't know, 2,400 counties in America, was the fifth highest increase in racial disparity of 328%. So that's why, and also that Minnesota prisons have the highest percent of blacks to white of any prison in America, of any state. So I thought, I have to get this stuff out, and I made a promise during my campaign, and I should have done some more advertising because I only lost by 1,000 points, but I'm still running as a write-in candidate to keep this subject alive. So it is just that there are financial incentives, federal and state, to arrest people for narcotics, and the easiest, simplest arrest is marijuana, and some young child or young man on the street, inexperienced policeman can arrest him in 5 minutes. So it's just phenomenal. So by making it public, which I did, and with the nice help of your colleague Don Ellens, he wrote a nice article, and that's why I hope everybody's listening, and I know both police, because it was Mr. Freeman, the Hennepin County prosecutor, because he sets the policy, and then there's the police chief of Minneapolis, then the police chief of St. Paul, and in St. Paul, it's okay, like if you're black and you live in Hennepin County, you are 9.1 times more likely to be arrested of marijuana than if you're white, and in St. Paul, it used to be 7.2 in 2010, and 2013 it's 8.8. So they get more money and more financial resources by the quantity of arrests, and nothing is simpler than staking someone out for 2 hours. So by bringing this public, and see, it's cause, and it has to be, even the American Civil Liberties Union said, by racial profiling, by unconstitutional stops, by frisking. So what I'm doing is keep pressing on this to educate the people in the neighborhood of their constitutional rights, of their Fourth Amendment rights. Like, can I search your car? Hell no. And they can't. You know, the people say, I don't know, or someone stops you walking on the street and say, we'd like to search you. You say, what am I doing? Well, you must look suspicious. I'm just walking on the street. So we have to keep pushing to let the people know that we live in America. We have a constitution, and they are protected, and they have to get informed. So by bringing the subject up, and I worked like for several weeks with people in the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and they very happy, and I'm very happy Eric Holder is still in office, so he will take a personal interest. You know, if a new guy just got there, there's a million things to learn and a million cases, but this we cannot afford. In fact, I personally wrote a separate letter to Eric Holder praying that he would make marijuana a Schedule II substance, because a Schedule II substance, a doctor patient, instead of all those months of wasting time like in the Minnesota legislature, then Obama, God willing, in his last weeks will legalize it and make every state tax it, because it's something that any high school kid can
Let me ask you a question, yeah. Dr. Shepherd, what you just said, because we just had a discussion with a constitutional expert about the possibility of the Republicans take control of the Congress. There's enough craziness there that they very well could be prepared to move for impeachment. I don't think the president can do that by executive order. I think that's a constitutional issue. Don't you agree? He can't do – said the president. The president cannot take that kind of action by executive order. I think he's got – that has to go through the legislative process.
Well, I know for sure 100% that the Attorney General can change the schedule of marijuana from 1 to 2 automatically. It is his right. I researched it, and it was in the report. And maybe
let's talk the hard politics. Don't you think that a Republican-controlled Congress, both House and Senate, don't you think that they would challenge the constitutionality? Oh, by the way, Holder will not be there. At that particular point in time, the Attorney General will only stay on until on an interim basis until his successor is appointed, which may not happen, if you will. But let's say that that does. Do you really think that the Republicans will sit quietly by in the Congress and allow that administrative act to be taken?
Well, the Attorney General has the right 100%. There's nothing they can say about it, and he can unclassify it. So he has the right more than the president. I think he can unclassify it, if you understand that. He has the right to...
Yeah, I understand it, but my question is...
It's legal. It's a law.
Well, I understand that, but I'm talking from the realism of what goes on in this country on a daily basis. We're a country, Mr. Shepherd, and I understand, I know you've been living in Italy and kind of away from the American scene. But we in Black America are well reminded that just this past year, the Supreme Court of the United States gutted the Civil Rights Voting Act of 1965. And so we know for, you know, 3 decades we'd been saying that we were well insulated and protected, and boom, it happened. The Justice Department didn't do anything. The president didn't speak out about it. And we're going to see some residuals, unfortunately, next Tuesday in different places across the country, such as North Dakota and et cetera. It's going to be much more difficult. Now, that's a voting issue, but it is one that has all kinds of constitutional aspects to it and et cetera. So I want to make sure I'm hearing you right. So you think that the Congress of the United States would sit quietly by and allow an Attorney General, whoever that may be, to make
administrative decision? No, it is his right. It's indisputable. He can change the scheduling of any narcotic.
I have to say, Dr. Shepherd, there's nothing indisputable in American
politics.
No,
it's his right. You know, they can do whatever they want, but when it's written that he has the right legally to do that, they can do whatever they want, but that's the law. But see, my running for the United States Senate, I'm still running as a write-in. In fact, it's more of a Dr. Martin Luther King peaceful protest.
Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated before, because of his commitment to the process and et cetera. But again, thank you, Mr. Allen. You have any questions? And because we may have some calls and et cetera.
Yeah, I'd just like to tell Dr. Shepherd that someone's been listening, because yesterday the ACLU released data showing racial disparities in low-level arrests in Minneapolis. And this was a report from the Minneapolis Police Department's own data reported to the Federal Bureau of Investigation Uniform Crime Reporting Division. And your numbers are right on. It says people are 11 times more likely to be arrested than a white individual for marijuana possessions, nine times more likely to be arrested than a white individual for disorderly conduct, and the last two, eight times more likely to be arrested than a white individual for vagrancy, and 15 times more likely to be arrested than a white individual for juvenile or curfew or loitering. So someone's listening, because now they brought this this new press release that was put out by Jan Corin yesterday on October 28th, from the ACLU here in the Twin Cities, and also with a letter to Mayor Hodges from Police Chief Artaud. And if you want to read those letters, they're at ourblacknews.com, and that's ourblacknews.com, all one word. And there's PDFs of the letters that people can check out. So what do you do from here?
Whoever has that letter, email it to me. It's just contact
Yeah, just go to ourblacknews.com and look at the story where your story is, and it's right there. You can just click on it and see the PDF and everything is right there.
Okay, thing is, what I accomplished, what I wanted, now it's public. When things are not public, they can get away with murder. But now
let me ask you a question, because we're running out of time with this portion. When do you expect your case to come to trial? Or to be heard by a court?
Well, it's whenever I want. See, what happened to me...
Whenever you want?
Yeah. Right now, I'm trying to get to Egypt again. I was in Gaza.
I'm surprised Gaza's still there. But when will your case, what calendar date are you discussing at this point? And who are your lawyers beside the Department of Justice?
Well, right now it's whenever I want. Except I'm a single father raising two teenagers, and my son is a child of needs, and I have the head psychiatrist who teaches.
Dr. Shepherd, I don't want to be disrespectful, but that wasn't the question. The question is, when do you expect this case to be heard? Now, normally in the federal court, if you ask for an acceleration, they may hear it within 6 months. If not, you're talking about a year, year and a half. So when do you think this case will be adjudicated?
My case?
Yeah, the case that you filed. Yeah.
That case. I don't know. It's just first day after they told me they send out investigators like in Borghese. They watch, they look, and you see this release of documents. Suddenly it's no surprise. Maybe they ask. For at first they ask politely, "Will you give us your data?"
Yes, yes. We understand that, sir. We understand the protocol and et cetera. But we're just trying. Mr. Allen kind of asked the question, "Where do you go from here?" And I'm asking the same question. And I guess my question was, what is your timeline for this case to quote unquote be heard in an American court? But why don't you do this? Why don't you get back to us when you have some firm dates on that, and who your attorneys are, and when you'll be returning to the United States to give deposition and testimony? Because I think that's just great.
Yeah, well, see, the situation is, it's a civil case. It's not a criminal case. And in civil cases, the case, the way they wanted me to write it, it's where they make the decisions, they find the policies, they decide if they're...
Oh, this is a class action. Okay, got you. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but
class, the class thing, action. Yeah.
No, but we got results already that they are showing it's even getting worse. But the important thing is to educate everybody about the Constitution, and every policeman, before he sees a little black guy standing on the corner thinking, that's money.
You know, let me just say this, Dr. Shepherd. I sure wish someone would have told Darren Wilson that in Ferguson, Missouri, as he blew Michael Brown's brains out of his head. You know what I mean? Maybe the Constitution and the importance of the constitutional equal protection under the law may have saved a young African-American. Okay, hey, well, thank you for calling. Give us a call back when you have some additional information. Mr. Allen, where are you at?
I'm ready to move on to the next topic. Our phone lines are open. It's 347-426-3904. Again, the number is 347-426-3904. And the phone lines, again, like I said, are wide open.
Because I'm interested in hearing some reflections on the observations made, particularly under color of law, by the professor as it pertains to responsibilities, as it pertains to nonprofits. I'm interested to hear what people's thinkings are, because I got a feeling there are a lot of nonprofits in our community that are not the house is not in order, if you will. They're not in compliance.
Yeah, and we have a caller, Mr. Edwards.
Okay, let's get them in.
You're live on the air. Go ahead. Who's calling and what's your question?
Hi, my name is Liz Paulson, and I just wanted to call in and say that I agree with the Hamlin professor about the importance of reaching out to our ethnic community and making sure that we're giving everyone a voice that we have as a Republican Party and as a Democratic Party, either taken the votes for granted and or just not authentically reached out to them as fellow human beings, giving them a voice. I'm a candidate who's running for House District 66B for that exact reason, because it matters so very much.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Paulson, just real quick here. Ms. Paulson, how is your campaign going? Because I have been seeing a lot of stuff on Facebook from you and different things. How's your ground, boots on the ground and door knocking and things going? How does it look for you next week?
Well, it's been this tremendous gift. Like just today, I met with 140 Hmong elders at a Hmong senior care center and just talked to them, and vast majority of them were impressed by my dedication to simply voice their priorities. And, you know, my understanding of what it means to be a multi-ethnic American. I'm Indian and white, and so there are many affinities in several of our traditional cultures between, you know, learning styles, priorities for education, stuff like that. So what I'm finding is that I'm getting a broad base of support from independents, Republicans, and Democrats who simply want to change. I went into this because I wanted to give our entire community a choice, and I'm seeing that people are reaching out for that. They're realizing that having somebody in for 13 years when they're really too busy to reach out and communicate and invest themselves in time with their community, that maybe it's time for a change.
Ms. Paulson, could you do this for our domestic, national, and international audience? What are the boundaries of the legislative district that you're talking about and that you're running in?
Okay, 66B starts at the Near East Side of St. Paul on Payne Avenue, and it that's to the east. And then to the north, it's Larpenter. To the south, it's Case. And then it goes all the way west to Como Park. So that's roughly the borders.
Okay. And the current incumbent in that district is who? You said 13 years?
John Lesh.
Okay. All right, then. There we go. All right. And you are, of course, clearly a challenger, correct?
That is. First time.
Okay.
I'm a school teacher, so I've ran for a school board before, but this is my first time ever running for state office.
All right, then. All right.
All right. Well, thanks for the phone call.
And the very best to you. Mr. Allen, go ahead.
Yeah, good luck, and thanks for the phone call, Ms. Paulson, and we look to see great numbers next Tuesday for you. Okay?
I'm hoping so, too. I just want to involve as many voters as possible in the whole process of choosing who's going to represent you so that you can hold them accountable for representing you well.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Get that phone number again, unless we have some people in the on the line ready to come in.
Yeah, caller, go ahead. You're live on the air.
Oh, all right.
Hello?
Yes, you're live on the air, sir.
Well, thank you very much. I've called in the past. I go by the moniker Mr. M.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mr. M, how are you doing today? What can we do for you?
Very, very good. Very good. Last time I talked to you, gentlemen, I was actually in Ferguson, and we had a very nice conversation from that area. But I did want to comment, just one comment on your the guest that you had, the legal guest that was providing some information to the community about the legal process. And one thing I wanted to bring up is I forget the name of this particular legal group. But years ago, this legal group used some of those same statistics to bring a lawsuit based on the disparities of individuals who are getting arrested for a certain crime but getting punished more severely for that crime, okay?
Okay.
And most of the ones getting punished more severely were African American, Hispanic, Native American, okay? And so they presented a statistical analysis of the actual crimes and the punishment that was being meted out across the board. And they presented a lawsuit. And this lawsuit went up the chain. And when it got to, you know, the legal, I don't know if it was the, I don't think it went as far as the Supreme Court, but whatever the highest court of that for that particular jurisdiction was said.
Probably the appeals court.
Probably appeals court. This information, they said, is irrefutable. I mean, the statistic information is very clear that people are getting arrested and being punished for the same crime, the amount of marijuana, the amount of drugs, the amount of whatever the crime was. But they said for our court to do anything about that would upset the fabric, okay, would cause so much upheaval that for us to try to write this would make things worse. and so they refused to act on it. The decision was that you're right. It's unquestionably that you're right. But for us to do something about it, so what that said to me, in one way, our laws seem to be enacted for the sole purpose of maintaining the status quo. For the sole purpose of keeping us, or keeping certain people, I'm not going to say who, I don't know who, keeping certain people in their place and maintaining a certain order.
You know, what's interesting about what your observation and analysis, M, is that argument of upsetting the status quo and et cetera, you got to remember that was the fundamental argument as it pertains to the issue of slavery, particularly in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, right up to Percy, right up to Plessy, if you will, which was used to reverse, if you will, but up to 1860, man, that was kind of the, not the law of the land, but the argument of the land. And so what you're talking about has been a part of the fiber of the American jurisprudence system for a long, long time when it comes to the issue of race.
I just felt compelled to bring that out in listening to the gentleman previously. I mean, and it was so interesting to hear your dialogue with the gentleman because you
oh, that
he
was Dr. Shepherd for calling us from Italy. Yes, yes.
He was presenting some very salient points. But I think you were asking some very salient questions that it seemed a little disconnected to me at times.
Yes, about if there's just a different vision sometimes as it pertains to the two Americas that unfortunately we reside in. Sounded great what he was saying. It's kind of like sound looks good on paper, but then when you drafted the kid, you found out that he couldn't catch. And so he became a first-round flop. Yeah, yeah. Anything else for us, Jim?
No, only that the Ferguson experience was very, 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 very interesting, and I know you gentlemen have really talked about that. I really appreciate you taking my call from Ferguson.
You taking the time to call us. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I took the number along with me just to just to do that. When I got there, and just it was really an eye opener to actually be there, to be present, to actually go by that gas station that had been burned down, to actually go by the place where the cigars apparently were. There's some dispute about what happened in that store on these cigars, and actually go by the spot exactly where the young man was shot. And
yes,
to see it on TV and to see it in person, you know, I tell you, there's a whole different thing. The things you see in person, you get a whole different perspective than what you see on television.
Absolutely.
And I'm not saying that it's always on purpose, but it's just when you're actually there and you see it, you could feel the memorial there. When you got by there, it was fairly, the person I was with, she just kind of just almost shuddered. She could just feel a shroud around her, you know.
Okay. We lost just a tad before you, when you came back and indicated the person that you were with. What was it specifically you were saying leading up to that? Because there was some kind of pause somewhere.
I was just saying that it was clear that the emotion there in that scene, when you saw all the flowers, you saw the memorial to the young man, and then as we talked about it and how the young man, after he was shot, he laid in that spot for hours.
Yes, yes.
And so to just see that this is just a neighborhood, this is just an apartment complex. And it was almost like you get to a dead end, so you can't see where people were walking across the streets everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
we appreciated both your personal call from Ferguson a couple weeks ago, as well as we have some what we call sources / stringers in Missouri.
Yeah.
People just don't understand that actually there have been demonstrations in Ferguson for the last 82 days since would be the time that young Michael Brown was killed, and then later on Mr. Myers was shot and killed in St. Louis. Mr. Powell was shot and killed a couple weeks after Mr. Brown. People don't understand that the St. Louis area, St. Louis County, City of St. Louis, and et cetera, has been a hotbed of protests and et cetera. And one of the things that I saw a couple of days ago was an interview being conducted by a couple of reporters from CNN in which the St. Louis County police, which is technically like the sheriff, are preparing for almost a state of siege. And what a young lady, a young African-American student there, said on CNN had to be Sunday, Mr. Allen and him. She said that there's already a very serious discussion by white authorities that they are prepared to declare a state of emergency and force you to stay, quarantine, if you will, in your home and not be able to move about on the street and et cetera. And I really haven't heard or saw that kind of plan since the days of the 1960s, including in this town when we had a state of emergency, and National Guard troops came in and secured and sealed North Minneapolis. Mm-hmm.
North Avenue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
people don't
I
like
heard
to talk just, about that.
I think I heard just the other day that the police chief might be resigning in Ferguson. I don't know. Had you heard that?
There's rumor to that. He's made such a fool out of himself. I'll tell you something that did happen, and they're pretty ticked. I'm talking about the white side, if you will. Officer Wilson, and by the way, he had a lot of felony cases that he had conducted arrests on. He has missed 5 hearings involving felony arrests that he made, and consequently those cases had to be dismissed. And so he clearly is being advised not to make any kind of appearance anywhere in the St. Louis area. 5 felony cases, gentlemen, have been dismissed in the last couple of weeks because Darren Wilson won't show up.
Very, 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 very interesting. But
yes,
my final comment is, before I let you gentlemen go, is that when I was in St. Louis, in Ferguson, your comments that this has been going on daily, that's what I noticed. It was a day-to-day thing. There was something going on every single day that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
related to the shooting and the unrest. I mean, it's just the national media, you just can't get a feel for it. It's like you were saying, it's a constant, and until this thing is resolved, how it's going to be resolved, I think that's going to continue.
I concur. All right, Em, appreciate it. Thank you, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
All right, take care, guys.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Allen, any other calls? Lines are open.
Lines are open. Number 347-426-3904. Lines are wide open here. I am just, Mr. Everett, I am flabbergasted at the school board race right now between, more particularly, former Minneapolis City Councilman Don Samuels, or the current director of school board, one of the directors, Rebecca Gadden, and these two kind of, Samuels is not really going back and forth, but it looks like on social media that Rebecca Gadden has a bunch of minions kind of working for her, posting things, talking about these billionaires giving money to the Minneapolis Public Schools or agencies affiliated, 50CAN, MPEF,
former mayor R.T. Ryback's organization. Yes.
And they're really shocked. And I'm looking at this big post right now of this particular, you know, it talks about New York millionaire Adam Claus, California billionaire Arthur Rock contributed $100,000, Connecticut billionaire Jonathan Sacker contributed $25,000, and Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York, $100,000. Well, there's a page like this for the Democrats, that their billionaires and millionaires contributed. And so when people are going to do this, you know, let's look at both sides. Let's look at, you know, the Democrat, Republican. I mean, they're the same body, just different heads. It just makes it pretty ridiculous when you're asking, that these are not the only people that contributed to these educational organizations in the Twin Cities, but these are the people signaled out because of their right thinking, their right political policy. So it just doesn't. It's not a good look for some of those folks out there on Facebook. I'm just glad to share that.
Well, I know you've been talking, Mr. Allen, about Don Samuels and his run and et cetera. And I notice, how are you personally responding to the allegations that he has become a kind of a pawn of the Koch brothers' grand plan for public education and et cetera in America, and that tremendous dollars are being poured into his campaign? I mean, is there some concern, or has there been any interest about that, the amount of money that's coming in for him?
Well, Mr. Evers, that's a good question. Let me unpack that for you for
okay.
a second here. Here goes the deal. Let's look first at the Minneapolis Public Schools, and let's just go from the year 2000 to 2000, well, till today, to 2014.
Go ahead.
And I am looking at the number of African-American.
But are you still with me, Mr. Allen?
Yes, I am. I am still here.
Mr. Allen is
okay.
Apparently clicked off.
I don't know if he knows
that he has done that.
Mr. Harris, can you hear me now? Hello?
Don, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Still here.
I don't hear anything.
Mr. Edwards, can you hear me now? Mr. Edwards? Mr. Edwards, I am live on the...
Hello?
Yes, I am here.
Yeah, Don, we lost you there for a minute, buddy.
Yeah, you know what? Something really weird is going on with the studio switchboard here, and we have had at one point almost six people on hold, and then they disappeared and they blinked off. But I think it's back to being normal for a quick second here. But
okay, all right. Well, you said you wanted to kind of attack the question, and go ahead, because I didn't hear what it was that you were saying. So
okay.
I don't want people to think that we blown into the great beyond. But go ahead.
No, okay, here we go. I'm looking at education in Minneapolis public schools from 2000 to 2014, basically today. And I look at the number of African-American children, males and females, that have not graduated from the Minneapolis public schools, that have actually dropped out, that have been suspended, expelled, and disenfranchised, and they're, basically their civil rights violated. Now,
okay.
I understand not everybody likes Councilman Don, former Councilman Don Samuels. I understand that people want to go with the DFL candidate, endorsed candidate, who works in school systems in Singapore but has neglected the Minneapolis public to bring any of that knowledge or that ability to the public school system here in her capacity as a board director. So getting back to your main question is that we need some kind of radical change. And I think Don Samuels, whoever you can get money from, is fine. I don't think he's a pawn for anybody. I think he's doing politics as politics dictate in this particular environment. See, policies are flaky. They imitate the atmosphere. So 25 years ago, this race would have looked a lot different if Don Samuels and Rebecca Gagnon was running. It would be probably...
Now, by the way, let's have true transparency, Mr. Allen. And that is, actually, there are three people running for two seats because there's a third person that no one ever talks about. But go ahead.
Okay, you're absolutely correct. And so in this case, Don Samuels is running. If he gets money from the Koch brothers, if he gets money from Bloomberg, so what? They have a privilege to do that if they so choose. Just like Rebecca Gagnon could get money from Michelle Obama if she wants to. She can get money from the various people that are millionaires that are connected with the DFL. But the thing is, what really rubs me the wrong way, I was looking at a report by this Rachel Schlesinger Berger of Star Tribune, I think that's her name, and she did a pie chart, Mr. Edwards, of the millions of dollars that the DFL has in their coffers, okay, year to date. And I'm looking at candidates like Sharon Sun running against Eric Paulson. I'm looking at some of these other Democratic candidates that are running for, like, local state House positions that cannot get a nickel from this organization. But yet they sit up there getting donations from millionaires and billionaires, and it's not trickling down. You have Joy Marsh Stevens running in Brooklyn Park, who was just sending out an email that she's trying to raise money to run radio ads. You have Reva Chambliss running in Brooklyn Park for city council, kind of in the same position. And so it looks like the three black women that are running for office under the moniker of the DFL aren't getting squat. So getting back to Don Samuels is free and clear. I think that he would be a welcome change. I predicted, 10 weeks ago, almost 2.5 months ago, that he would win next Tuesday. I predicted Rebecca Gagnon would lose. And Don Samuels and Iris will be the ones that move forward. Now, this gives the community an opportunity to hold Don Samuels accountable. Okay?
Like they did for 8 years on the city council? Is that what you're saying?
So, Edwards, you know, me and you is the only one going down to the meetings and raising hell, because people would not do that. People would not ask these questions. People would not write. They had no class. They wouldn't do anything to even question him, and that was a great opportunity. So now this is their second, their born-again awakening, their second spiritual awakening. They can go to Director Samuels and say, hey, this is going on. But also, Mr. Edwards, in the background, we have to look at Northside Achievement Zone, who's done absolutely nothing.
Now, that's the organization ran by his wife, right?
Yes, Sandra Samuels, who has, let me just, like this, I shouldn't say they have done absolutely nothing. They haven't done a damn thing for pre-K education, because there are guys like this guy named Tom Wolfgram, who has a whole business plan to get kids in the community to read before they hit kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Northside Achievement Zone is not even talking to this guy. And so it's very disheartening to even see this.
But why don't we do this, Don, on that particular? It's too bad, because by the time we're on again, the election will have already been held. But, you know, you should invite this guy to come on so he can tell us his story. and tell us how the achievement zone has ignored his proposal.
Yeah,
and so that's something. Why don't you try and do that for next Wednesday?
Yeah, I will try to do that. And also, we have three callers, Mr. Edwards. I'd like to get to them. They've been holding.
Let's
for about
get to them. Go right in. Let's get to them. Callers are the most important thing. Go ahead, caller.
Chair, go ahead.
Caller. Hello, this is Brother James.
Hey, Brother James.
Yeah, Brother James. Go right ahead.
Don Samuels was on.
Talking about burning down the high school. Yeah.
Yeah, he was on KFAI this week, and a middle-aged Caucasian woman called in. She was the only person that called in, and she stated clearly in her opening statement, she said she didn't like the fact that he mentioned burn down North High. He talks down to black people like as if he is from some other place around the world. And
well, he is. He's from Jamaica.
Up, and then he summed it up as if to say, yeah, I am the man, and everybody on the panel laughed at him, and they said, oh, wow, we didn't know we had the man on here. We didn't have, yes, I am
okay.
the man. Yeah, I am the man. And they
okay.
said, oh, we didn't know we had
the
man on the show. Then he
yeah.
tops it all off to say he's a descendant of slaves. And I said, well, isn't this the same Don Samuel that said, stated clearly before he even got into politics and politicking that he was a house Negro, and he was glad to be a house Negro?
Mr. Allen, you have to kind of respond to that.
Well,
I don't know how we deal with that.
I got to respond to Brother James. You're absolutely correct in everything that you
okay,
just said.
Okay, I'm going to go further than that. Just hold your horses. We don't need to all
ahead,
of that.
Go ahead.
Don Samuels received that $28 million from a dead gentleman by the name of Kenneth B. Nelson, who wrote that grant for him. He was a master grant writer, and
okay,
now
okay,
that he's deceased,
Brother James,
nobody's
Brother
even
James.
Asking where is that gentleman? How did he die? How come Mr. Samuels didn't even send a dozen of roses down to South Bend, Indiana, to that gentleman's funeral? There were only two Caucasian people who was in attendance at that gentleman's funeral.
Okay, for clarity, Don Samuels did not get the $28 million. His wife did, and it was signed off on by Superintendent Johnson, Congressman Keith Ellison, the board of the Minneapolis Public Schools, and Amy Klobuchar, Al Franken, and a bunch of those people that went straight to NAS. I mean, I understand your point
Don Allen, you know that Kenneth B. Nelson wrote that grant for them.
He wrote the grant also for UROC to get the money for the $3.6 million for the Board of Regents and got fired after they got the money.
Ain't that how the game go? You help me
yeah.
get the dough, and out the dough you go.
Yeah. Exactly. And
Don, that doesn't make him a political pawn. That makes him a political tool. And if you can recall, Don Samuels came over here from St. Paul with some mental health issues. Don Samuels came to this country on mental health. Help me. I need some help. I've been persecuted in my country. Now, when you find these type of Negroes in Minnesota, when they can sit themselves out there, when they can be used, they are the right wing too for the right wing job. It doesn't surprise me that the DFL now wants to use him because he got some money. But the money that he got, he stated clearly in that grant that money was supposed to be going to poor kids in that area code of where he's from. It didn't say nothing about by yourself.
James,
I'd
like to have you do this because nobody ever talks about Mr. Nelson. Give us a little background on Mr. Nelson. And those other two calls, we would ask them just to hold because we still have about 11 minutes. Give us a background because, see, I thought that no one was ever going to talk about Mr. Nelson. Tell us who Mr. Nelson was, who unfortunately is now deceased.
Mr. Nelson was a computer wizard. And Don Allen, you know this, he came to Minnesota by way of Duluth first. I mean, Rochester first. He helped the Somalian community up there. He started the initiative on the computer, the broadband initiative. He started all of that.
That was
Johnny Come Laters. They didn't know anything about that because a lot of people didn't know he was a master grant writer.
Mm-hmm.
A lot
and
of people didn't know he was a master
yep.
grant writer.
Yep. You're absolutely correct.
That man practically sat in his apartment over in South Minneapolis. He was poor, broke, and hungry, and nobody came to his aid. Nobody even gave him a Christmas dinner, and he died just before the night of Christmas. Don, you know I brought that to your attention.
Yep, you sure did.
When that went down.
Yep.
And they took him back
to your attention when that went down.
Yeah, took him back to South Bend to be buried. No one ever wanted to talk about Mr. Nelson.
With no help in his South Side apartment, and none of these here so-called help me write this grant, brother. You can go right now to his old website, and it's still up.
Oops.
His mother is still hurt and distraught for the simple fact that they used that brother and didn't even have the decency.
Give us if you have it in front
apart.
Of you, James. If not, we'll do it. Give us the call letters of his website. Do you have it offhand?
No, I don't have it right offhand.
All right, Don, have Don check it in, because we would encourage people to go to his website, because that in itself is one hell of a story.
Yeah. I'm actually looking
See,
for
I
right
think that, that people have been led to believe that Sandra Samuels wrote, quote-unquote, that grant.
If you can recall, Sandra Samuels was touting herself when Don got in there as a city councilman as a stay-home wife.
Right.
She didn't know anything about schooling. She didn't know anything about – and there's another gentleman that calls your show on the regular, Brother Wes. He will tell you, I donated books to a school that was ran by the Urban League that was the personal library of Gary Sutter. You know Gary Sutter had the most outstanding black history library in the country. Them
people and
wanted
some of it
me
is still at
Sutter the
Library.
So they can destroy the books. I gave the books to that school called Right Step Academy, and when Right Step Academy folded under, because you remember, Mr. Edwards, the husband and the wife team plundered the money into that.
We're talking about
I
the
think
Wilsons.
They went to jail.
You're also talking about. That's right. Yes. You're going awful deep on some folks, because the administrator there was a former basketball coach, current basketball coach, in fact, at one of our high schools. Oops. All right, then, Brother James, we got a couple more calls.
Hey, Mr. Edwards, 1 second here. I found, if you go to tech.mn/news 2010, Ken Nelson's piece up there is What is the Digital Divide and Why Does It Matter to Minnesota? Get to Know Number 13, Ken Nelson. And he
All
has
right.
a detailed piece. I remember this guy, I met him at UROC, and he was really complaining because the former head of the Business Technology Center over there and the BTEC Center was giving him a real hard time. And
now, I want to say this, gentlemen. Mr. Allen, I don't want to cut you off, but I need to say this here and make it clear. When that gentleman was working at UROC, they staged for some Caucasian girl to come in the office, borrow his phone, only to run off with his phone and got some numbers out of his phone, and it was with the Apple and the IBM people because he had thick connections with the top-flight computer companies, and they stole the numbers out of his phone and called those people and tried to receive some money from those individuals.
Yeah. It was a matter put under pressure, and a man by the name of Craig Taylor knew all about it. Uh-oh, look out.
No.
All right, Brother James, thank you.
All right, stay woke.
All right. If we still got those calls, Don, let's try to get them in. We've got a couple minutes left here.
Call, you live on the air. Go ahead. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're live on the air.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's Paula Overby, candidate
for
Congress in the 2nd District.
Go right ahead. Don, go ahead. This is one of your people. Go ahead.
Yeah, Paul Overby running for the 2nd District against Klein. So is that debate going to happen on Sunday?
I believe so, yeah.
So he's
I'm a little surprised that he's agreeing to it, but I think his public presentation is suffering a little bit, and I think he's been told he's got to get out there in front of the people, so hopefully he'll show up.
That is great. Maybe we could invite Bill Maher to come up on his case, Bill Maher is. That's great. That's great. Anything else that you want to say while we've got you on the air?
Well, I don't know. I did outreach for the DFL for a couple of years. That's what I did. Engaged extensively with various cultures, including the black community. Well aware of the disparity of justice and income equality. Also, well aware of the fact that the black community is a very strong voting bloc for the DFL.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And it doesn't seem like they ever get anything from the DFL. I've seen them denied again and again and again. I've seen the Council Black on Minnesota and all of the bills that they've submitted, and not one of them acted upon. I'm just wondering how you see that and how you see the evolution of that in the DFL party. Do you expect that?
That'll be something we'll certainly talk about next week, though it will be after the election. But that's a keen observation. Mr. Allen and myself have been making those observations. I've been making those observations for over 50-some years. Appreciate you calling in, and we encourage you to call back and give us the results of what happened. Thank you, sir.
Great.
All right,
thank you very
take
much.
Care.
Thank
All
you
right,
very much.
Fine. We have a final caller, Don, or where are we at?
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead, please. Who's calling? Hello, caller, you're live on the air.
Okay. We probably lost him, and we appreciate your folks holding on for as long as they did.
Yep.
A lot of callers tonight, a lot of reflections, information, and et cetera. And I got to tell you, I appreciate Brother James raising the question and to some degree the ghost of Mr. Nelson. Because, see, Don, I know there are a lot of people that think that Sandra wrote that proposal, if you will, with the help of former Mayor Don Frazier and a whole crew of people who used to meet over in Southeast Minneapolis, if you will. Boy, that was quite a revelation. But this has just been a great program. Let us just say this. Be sure to get out and vote on Tuesday. It's important. There are a lot of interesting contests going on for House seats, if you will. There are no seats up for the Minnesota Senate. Of course, Congressman Keith Ellison really doesn't have any challengers, if you will, and basically has been kind of running his campaign in a way that indicates he feels no threat and et cetera. So, but we encourage people to get out, get yourself ready mentally to vote in 2016. Because this is going to be a very interesting country, Mr. Allen, in 2016. And I certainly appreciate the professor spending almost a half hour. You know, I hope that Hamlin as an institution and its leadership feels proud of him because he has certainly been a bright beacon, if you will, of reflection and honest interpretation of what the Constitution and other kinds of things are. So just want to kind of thank the professor. But more importantly, like I said before, Don, I just know that Hamlin is very proud of what he has brought to that institution over there in St. Paul. Would you not agree?
I would agree with you 100% on that, Mr. Evers. Absolutely.
Absolutely. All right, Don, we can get ready to have James Brown take us on home and take us towards election night next Tuesday.